Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comics conversation site. This is John Suntress. In comic books, there are two ways the phenomenon known as the event book happens. There's a design event, where the publisher creates a new editorial direction for a group of books, supported by monthly hype through ads and interviews. Then there's the word-of-mouth event, where the right creators match up with the right character, creating a mass audience demand that requires the publisher to go back to press and create more copies of a single title. In 1986, while Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen were living up to fan and marketing expectations, at Marvel, artist Mike Zeck and writer Stephen Grant revitalized the Punisher, at best a third-tier character, into a classic book that sold out across the country in hours. His mainstream work has varied from writing Spider-Man and Batman to the biography of Pope John Paul II. Today, Grant continues to connect with readers through his weekly column at Comic Book Resources, Permanent Damage, plus his original crime stories, like Damned, Badlands, and Whisper. Our conversation begins with Grant explaining how he began his career at Marvel Comics. Roger Stern is the guy that brought you to Marvel?
Yeah, sort of. I brought myself to Marvel. Roger and I had known each other for a few years due to fandom. There was a regular convention, I think, every month in Chicago that I'd go down there from Wisconsin. He and Bob Layton and a few other people would come up from Indianapolis every third Sunday. And so we got to know each other fairly well. And then a couple years later, Roger ended up getting a job as an editor at Marvel, or an assistant editor or something. I mean, it was some sort of editorial position. Then in like early 1970, late 77, early 78, he got bumped up to being, this is right after Jim Shooter became the editor-in-chief there, he made Roger an editor. And I occasionally went in. Now, before this, I had written a few things, but Roger and I had generally agreed that probably, straight comics, as we called them then, was probably not going to be my home in life. And, you know, I was pretty comfortable with that concept. And when I would go to New York, I'd stay with Roger, and I'd done it a couple of times. And it was Easter, and my girlfriend at the time was going to interview for some job in New York. She was graduating college. So I was going to ride in with her and spend the week in New York, which over Easter weekend. And I called up Roger and said, is it okay if I come stay with you? I'll probably be in on Sunday night. And he said, yeah, that's fine. Just be ready to write an issue of Marvel 2-in-1 on Monday morning. And I said, okay. And that was pretty much it. When he took over I'm not sure how this is possible, but he told me that when he took over the book, it was 18 months behind.
Wow.
There's no way that's possible, so I think he might have been exaggerating. But that was his excuse for telling me to do an issue. So I went in, I got there like 10:30 on a Sunday night, and then went into Marvel in the morning. He lived out in Brooklyn at the time, so it was a long commute. Went into Marvel at like 8 o'clock in the morning, sat down in front of a manual typewriter that they had there in the office, typed out a plot for an hour, and pretty much off the top of my head, which it reads like that if you look at it now. And, you know, it was just a goof. I wasn't really planning to do anything, to break any ground or anything. If he needed an issue, I figured I'd write one. Sounded like fun. So I turned in the plot. He went over it, made a few notes on it, handed it back to me, told me make changes. So I sat down for another hour, typed it out with changes in it, and handed it to him. He read it over, jotted a couple notes on the side, and handed me a voucher and said, here, and filled it out. And, you know, about 3-4 weeks later, I got a check out of it, and I thought, well, you know, this is more money than I'm making at what I'm doing now. And that was pretty much it. And I wanted to get out of it. I was living in Madison, Wisconsin, which is where I grew up, and I had been wanting to get out of there for a long time. So I thought, yeah, it's probably a good way to get out. So that was pretty much it. I mean, I wish I could say something inspirational or like that I had always been dying to do comics, which I had been, but by that point I kind of put that aside. And pretty much my movement into comics as a profession was a monetary consideration.
Sure. Were the comic books that spoke to you at the time before joining Marvel more of the counterculture stuff, the crumb stuff, and the underground stuff?
Well, you know, I liked all of it. I mean, I'd grown up on DC and Marvel superheroes. And then, you know, I mean, one of the great things about being in Madison is it was a very radical town in the late 60s, early 70s, and we had great resources for that kind of thing. Tons of music coming in, tons of, well, I mean, they had the best bookstores in the country were in Madison, Wisconsin. Beats anything they had in New York. I couldn't believe it when I got to New York and found out how bad the bookstores were there. And, yeah, they had incredible access to underground comics. So, You know, I read all of them. I mean, I read everything. There was a lot that I liked about the spirit of Underground Comics. And as a matter of fact, I had almost broken into Underground Comics doing work for Dennis Kitchen and had a book all prepared to go for him and was in his office the day that, in 1973, and I remember this very clearly, the day that the Supreme Court handed down its obscenity ruling saying that it was entirely up to locales as to what was considered the various individual cities as to what was considered obscene or not, and Dennis just turned around and said, well, that's it for Underground Comics. And that was it for Underground Comics. So that was my short Underground Comics career. It lasted about an hour.
Well, let me ask you about Marvel 2-in-1. Now, was that the Thing team-up book?
Yes, it was the Thing team-up book. I did a Thing Moon Knight story, which was obviously just for a joke. Well, when I was there, I said that I was the only guy in the only writer at Marvel who had talent at Marvel who had a DC nickname.
What was your DC nickname?
Well, you know, it's like, you know, the people at Marvel were like, you know, Raving Roger Stein. I don't remember what they called Roger. I'm just pulling on our word, you know. But
sure.
Jaunty Jim Starlin and things like that.
Certainly.
You know, Rascally Roy and all that. So that was like a Marvel nickname.
Uh-huh.
Now, in the, particularly in the Julie Schwartz books in the early 60s, when they'd refer to Hal Jordan in a caption, they'd put Hal parentheses Green Lantern close parentheses Jordan, or Barry parentheses The Flash close parentheses Allen, so that you knew who they were. If you'd never come in on the book before, you knew who they were. So
okay.
I turned out to be Stephen parentheses Moon Knight Grant.
Wow.
So I was the only one at Marvel with a DC nickname, which was pretty much the state of my existence at Marvel. I was never really a terribly good fit at Marvel.
Well, but you did a lot of work there, certainly, and you had a decent run on Marvel Team-Up with Spider-Man. Now, were you...
That was sort of a cheat.
In what way?
That was a bunch of fill-ins that we snuck into snuck together, Mark Gruenwald and I. So they were all individual fill-in issues, and we did them in continuity. I mean, we did them as a continuous run for, like, I think 3 or 4 of them. So.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask, with that and maybe 2-in-1, how long were you on 2-in-1 then?
Oh, just one year. I only did one issue of 2-in-1.
Okay, because I was going to ask, with Team Up, were you able to choose the co-stars, or was that an editorial edict?
Oh, no, we were able to choose the co-stars. The only issue of Team Up that I ever did that they chose the co-stars for me was the Hulk and Spider-Woman, which was just a horrible story. Just an abomination of a story. It was like one of those stories that you start out with one idea, and somehow in the process of going through editorial, it ends up as something completely different.
Okay.
So you have to figure out ways to like salvage your interest. I don't remember what it was supposed to be, but I remember the end result. Yeah, I chose them. I mean, Mark Gruenwald, who was editing the book through part of it, I think Alan Milgram was the original editor in the book, and then Denny O'Neill took it over, but Mark was Denny's assistant, and Mark was basically the guy who was editing the book at that point. I mean, he and I talked about it, but it was all our choices. I mean, I chose Hawkeye because I liked Hawkeye, you know.
Sure.
I wanted to do a Shroud story. I forget what the connection with the Shroud was. I mean, I'd always kind of liked the character, and he was a character no one really did anything with, so... You know, those always attracted me because no one really cared what you did with them, so you could get away with stuff. And as opposed to, like, using one of the X-Men where everyone's all over you about it.
How dare you, yes.
And, well, you know, I did the Beast.
It seems, too, you did a lot of Spider-Man work on the Electric Company books as well.
Right, right.
So, yeah, you've had a lot of Spider-Man stuff, and it's interesting, too, because, you point to some of the Underground Comics and that you maybe weren't a good fit for Marvel, but, man, you did a lot of stuff for Marvel and was very versatile, too, doing kid-friendly stuff like the Electric Company stuff, and then, and we'll get to it in a few minutes, your Punisher stuff.
Well, the Electric Company stuff, things like the Electric Company and the Pope book and things like that,
mm-hmm.
were basically, I was Marvel's dumping ground. I was the guy who got the assignments that they didn't want to waste their real talent on.
Wow.
So that's how I ended up doing those books. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm you know, I'm not, like, assaulting Marvel for it, but that's just the standing that I generally had in the company. Because, you know, I was known as being fairly reliable, and I don't want to go into the politics of it. There was a certain amount of politics going on in it. But, yeah, I mean, things like the Electric Company where they had to have someone turning in scripts. You know, they certainly weren't going to have Frank Miller writing it. You know?
Well, let's talk about the John Paul II book, because it's kind of funny that I would say your two biggest Marvel books would have to be the Punisher miniseries and on the other end of the bookshelf, the biography of John Paul II.
Well, they're certainly the two Marvel books I made the most money off of, I can tell you that.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not really sure how I ended up on the Pope book, because Joe Duffy had done, I think, the Francis of Assisi book before that. And, I mean, that was what started, because they had cut some deal with the Franciscans.
Okay, because I knew about the John Paul I book. I remember that one, too.
Right. Well, that was before it. They had cut some deal with the Franciscans to do a book about St. Francis of Assisi, which actually did fairly well. And there was this guy who worked for Marvel named Gene Pelk. He was their sales representative in Japan. Okay, he was a Polish-American sales representative in Japan.
Okay.
Who got the idea when they did the St. Francis book. He may have had something to do with the St. Francis book as well. I'm not really clear on that. He got the idea of doing a book about the Pope, you know, biography, doing a comic book biography of the Pope.
Sure.
Because, you know, it was his Pope, you know, his Polish-American, Polish-Catholic Pope. And I assumed that Joe Duffy was going to do it. You know, it never occurred to me that I'd end up on the job.
Sure.
And we used to have these summer afternoons, Friday afternoons, we used to all go, bunches of us used to go out to Ralph Macchio's house on Friday afternoons to swim and barbecue. And we're in his pool, and Joe's there, and I ask her about the, you know, and I make some comment about the Pope book, and somebody says, "I thought you were doing that." And, you know, and Joe's going, "Oh, no, I'm not having anything to do with that." And I had no idea what her objection was and still don't. But she was, like, adamant. She was, I think she just didn't want to get typecast as the religious writer.
Okay.
And and someone said, "Aren't you doing that book?" I said, "I don't think so. And if I am, nobody's mentioned it to me." And they said, "No, I'm sure you're the one who's writing the book." And I said, "Oh, okay. Nobody's mentioned it to me." So Monday morning, I'm in the offices, and I get called into Jim Shooter's office, and he says, we want you to write the biography of the Pope. And I said, "Oh, that's interesting. Okay."
So how'd you go about, you know, what kind of resource materials did you use in terms of research?
Well, I read gobs and gobs and gobs of books. And then we spent 2 days interviewing a Polish priest through an interpreter. I mean, he partially spoke English, and we had an interpreter.
Okay.
And basically got the whole biography. He'd been a friend of the Pope's. He'd more or less grown up with him. And,
okay.
He gave me, just endless volumes of detail. And, you know, it was a job. It was entertaining. And I always like challenges, you know. I always like having different things to write.
Were you able to get, you know, some of the interesting stories that came out, I know, after his death? I mean, we found out about things about his, you know, things that he did during World War II to kind of help some people out, or was it more of a traditional kind of classic comics safe story?
Well, it was relatively safe. I mean, I couldn't go too far. As far as I know, I don't want to poke any holes in any myths, but a lot of the things that they were coming out with about what he did after the war came up in the process of the interview, and I was basically told they were nonsense.
Oh, really? Okay.
So, you know, but those were circulating at the time, and, you know, basically it's building the myth of the Pope.
Sure.
So and we stripped out as much of the pure myth of it as we could figure out. And so we don't cover a lot of his adventures. I mean, according to his friend, according to his friend the priest, he basically spent World War II in a seminary. I mean, it was a real bad idea to stick your neck out at that point. But, you know, so I did as much as I could with it. But it's, you know, I mean, I think it's a good book. I'm not saying
sure.
It's a bad book or anything. And it gets the job done. But in terms of, you know, breakthrough storytelling or anything, it's, I mean, we don't have any sex scenes or anything in it. So, yeah.
All right, well, let's go to the other end of the spectrum then and start talking about Circle of Blood. I got now, I remember I was a college student when this came out, and I was one of those guys that was so upset that when issue one came out and went to my comic book store, I was told, no, it's already sold out. And
yeah,
I'm like,
well,
you just opened up. How can it have already sold out?
Well, it's a funny story about that. Well, first of all, I had originally pitched that to Marvel in 1976, half-heartedly. This is before Roger had moved to New York. Duffy Voland, who worked in the production department of Marvel, did some inking, things like that. And Duffy's couch was notorious. Everyone stayed on Duffy's couch at one point or another in the mid-70s. I had gone out for a convention for Christmas, and Duffy said, well, you're going to pitch anything. You know, you should pitch something to Marvel while you're here. And I'm thinking, wow, that sounds like a really dumb idea. But Duffy went and, you know, set it up with me that I could go in. And Marv Wolfman does not remember this at all, but I went and had an interview with Marv Wolfman. Before that, I came up with, you know, I sat down and came up with three ideas that I wanted to pitch them. Let's see, one was a Punisher series, one was a Black Knight series, and I completely forget what the third one was. But the Punisher series was essentially what I what became Circle of Blood. It was somewhat elaborated, but that was the basic idea. And, you know, Marv was kind of lukewarm to it, but I appreciated that he took the time for an interview, and, you know, wasn't really expecting him to start throwing work at me or anything. So, you know, it was an interesting experience. So I kind of sat there and nursed that for a long time. And I would periodically pitch it to people. But the thing is, the Punisher had a very bad reputation at Marvel. He was pretty much considered, first of all, most of the editors considered him a bad guy. Wait, for understandable reasons, I always considered him a bad guy, which was made him interesting to write. And just the principle of him made him a villain, you know, which I was perfectly happy to work with. I didn't like the idea of rubber bullets. I thought, you know, a guy who was going to go to that extreme would probably be a little over the top. But you know, they were under their own restrictions at the time. And, you know, Jerry has said that what he really always wanted to do with the Punisher is what I ended up doing. So, you know.
That's cool.
Yeah, but he just wasn't in a position to do it which seems a little strange to me that I managed to do something that they wouldn't let Jerry Conway do because, you know, Jerry was like a god for a long time there.
Sure.
I pitched that all over the place to every editor up there, and all of them said, you know, nah. We don't want to do it. And then I had worked with Mike Zeck on one of the Marvel team-up books that we talked about and liked working with Mike, thought he did a great job on the book, and knew he was coming off of Secret Wars at the time, decided to give him a call. So I give him a call and say, you know, I'm trying to get this Punisher miniseries off the ground. I was wondering if you want to work on it. He said, well, you know, that's really strange. I said, what? Said, you know, I'm up here with John Beatty. We're sitting right here, and we were talking about what we wanted to do next, and both of us just 2 seconds ago said, man, you know, I'd really love to do The Punisher. And I said, oh, okay. So I went to Carl Pott and pitched to him because I knew he was looking for stuff. And I don't think Carl was all that interested in doing The Punisher, but he wanted Mike in his stable because at that point the editors all wanted their own, were all supposed to be developing their own stables of writers and artists.
Okay.
And so we took that, you know, so, and it developed from there, and Carl was very supportive of it. And Carl was actually getting a lot of flack over it. Originally, there was no intention of releasing it anytime soon. It was just they were doing it because Carl wanted to do it. You know, they were letting us do it just to appease Carl, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then something came. There was something that fell apart on them, and they had to get something, and they jammed it in on the schedule real quick, which eventually caused problems down the line because suddenly, instead of having all the time in the world to do the book, we were like 2 months late, and. But anyway, at that point, somebody or other from the marketing department, this is about a week before it comes out, came out, somebody from the marketing department runs into me in the hall at Marvel and says, you know, Marvel's readers are not going to be interested in stories about a psychopathic killer. And I said, yeah, you're probably right. And, you know, I mean, why am I going to bother arguing with that? A week later, the book comes out, and before noon, it's sold out everywhere in the country.
Yeah.
Dealers are calling Marvel, begging them for more copies. They don't have more copies. As a matter of fact, I think the Southeast didn't even get it on their order sheets.
Oh, my God.
You know, I mean, it's like they didn't even bother getting the whole country to order the book. And suddenly, I'm suddenly getting calls from all over the place on Friday afternoon. And Friday morning, I find out that Marvel has instituted the first overship program in the business for The Punisher number 3.
Wow.
Because, you know, they've already done all the orders for number 2. And, you know, so anyway, so that was my little you know. So I was right, they were wrong, nah.
Well, that's the thing. There was anticipation for Dark Knight. There was some anticipation for Watchmen because of Alan Moore's reputation. And, you know, yeah, there really wasn't that much publicity on this Punisher thing. It was the word on this was kind of smuggled out, and we were all excited to get it, and it wasn't there.
Yeah, no, it was clear out of the blue.
Yeah.
Clear out of the blue. And what was the punchline on that? There was something that happened after that. I don't remember. It'll come back to me at some point.
Well, I'm glad that that Bradstreet brought it up in the feature on the DVD for the film, and gave you guys props, because it really was. I mean, this was the story that kind of made things explode. I'm always curious because...
Oh, that was what I was going to tell you, but go on, ask your question.
Okay, well, no, feel free. It's either way.
Oh, no, go ahead and ask the question. Well, I'll remember the story.
Well, because I want to jump back and talk about the comparisons between the Punisher and Don Pendleton's character, the Executioner.
I never read the character.
Okay, because I was going to ask you, it seemed like Pendleton was a willing fan of the Punisher, and I know...
Really? I had no idea.
Well, it seems like he was cool with it to a degree. I know that he wrote a text feature for one of the black and white Punisher things that predated your guys' story.
Okay, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, they Marvel obviously ripped the character off from the Executioner. There's no doubt about it.
Sure. I mean, yeah, it was a one-man war against the mob. His family was wiped out by the mob as well. And you know, it was one of those male paperbacks that I don't know how many comic book readers are aware of, younger comic book readers, but, you know, it was kind of interesting.
Right, right.
All the romance companies coming out with a line of male books as well. And, yeah, the Destroyer was the
Executioner.
The Executioner, yes.
The Destroyer was sort of the parody of the Executioner, although the one that I liked best was the Inquisitor, who was the Pope's private assassin.
Right, the Destroyer was Remo Williams, and
right.
The Executioner was Mac Bolan. Okay,
right.
I didn't know about the Inquisitor.
Yeah, well, the Inquisitor was one. I mean, I think whoever wrote Gorky Park wrote those under
a
pseudonym. But of course, I didn't find that out until years later. But I never read them. But I used to read the back covers of the paperbacks and laugh my head off.
Sure.
So you know, because those things were just hysterical. It was something like freed from bonds of celibacy and authorized to kill the Pope, you know. It was great fun just to read the back covers of those things.
You can do whatever you want, son. That's all right. The Pope's giving you the okay. You got the golden seal. Have fun.
But anyway, I'm in Heidi Ho Comics. The day the Punisher comes out, the Punisher number one comes out, I go to Heidi Ho Comics. And they've already sold out. I think they had one copy behind the counter they were holding on to for somebody.
Okay.
And this kid is in there. He's probably like 14, 15 years old. And he's just like, when he finds out who I am, he just starts raving about how great it was and how it was just such a cool comic and how went so far beyond anything Marvel had ever done before. And he's like going through and he's killing all these people and just blah, blah, blah. And I'm listening to him very politely. And I said... And when he's done, I said, you know, he doesn't kill anyone anywhere in that book. And he goes, what, you're kidding? I said, no, if you read it, he doesn't actually kill anyone anywhere in that book. And he goes and he reads the thing. You know, he gets one copy they've got sitting there, and he flips through it, like frantically flips through it every page. And when he's done flipping through it, he's just got this look of awe on his face, and he says, wow, you're right. It's like everyone remembers him just like being on a killing spree in that issue, and I think that was part of the impact, is that it really came across. Somehow we managed to pull it off without him actually doing anything to go against the comics code. We managed to make it look like he was just everything you ever wanted to see the Punisher be, you know. And there were apparently a lot of people out there who really liked the character, but they just hated what Marvel did with it, you know. So.
Well, yeah, and limited to the all ages, I think, mentality of the times.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, I think serendipity. You guys, you know, came along with this, or at least were allowed to come along with the story at the right time when things were finally shaking up in the mid-'80s.
Well, yeah, and I also think, and this is probably self-aggrandizing of me, but I also think that we had an awful lot to do with a lot of things that happened later in terms of what people started doing in their stories and how characters started turning increasingly violent and nasty, which was not really what we set out to do. But I think we, you know, and a lot of people tend to put the blame for that on, like, Dark Knight and things like that. But I honestly don't think that it was, because there was this perception of, like, guys like Alan and Frank at the time and Howard were probably the three who were most, you know, associated with the with high-end violent books.
Howard Chaykin.
Howard Chaykin, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, Howard Chaykin.
Certainly.
But they were considered to be on a different plane from everybody else. You know, and I don't think that had it simply been them that it would have had the wide impact across the board, particularly at Marvel and DC. I think there was a perception that this was a ordinary character because he had been perceived in the offices of that to that point as being a dull, basically a third-rate guest star character.
Sure.
You know, done by people who were not top echelon people. I mean, certainly we didn't think of ourselves that way, but there was definitely that vibe in the air.
Okay.
And it was a runaway hit regardless. So I think that gave people the idea that, you know, I don't have to be a superstar to be able to do stuff like this.
Sure.
You know, so in that regard, I think we had an awful lot of effect on the comics after that. Not that I'd necessarily want to have that effect, but, you know, I think it can be traced back to us more than, in a lot of ways, more than it can be to things like Dark Knight and Watchmen.
No, it definitely opened a door, and yeah, we did see more deconstruction, and there was another perception of the Punisher, and I would say of Miller's Batman as well at the time, and I'm curious, as a pretty obvious, self-evident liberal, given some of your writings, especially in your column.
I think probably a little beyond liberal.
All right.
Go on.
What, progressive?
Liberal
it?
By default. Yeah, I'd go for progressive.
I like progressive as well. Well, I'm curious because it seems like Miller's Batman and your Punisher were given the Reagan-era heroes label. And I always thought that was kind of interesting. The conservatives seem to almost embrace these interpretations, and this was a hero for the Reagan era.
I don't think what they got about either of our characters is both of them were anarchists.
Yeah.
Now, Frank and I used to talk about this all the time. You know, Frank and I saw a lot of each other when we were living in New York and Los Angeles. I don't see much of them anymore because we're on other sides of the country. But you know, we're still friends and all that. But,
sure.
But we used to talk about this stuff a lot. And, Frank's Batman is a pure anarchist. The Punisher, you know, I had this conversation that the Punisher is not a conservative. The Punisher is an anarchist, which a lot of people didn't get. But this is a guy which it was something that I pumped up without saying in the graphic novel that Mike and I did. This is a guy who does not believe in the reign of law. Obviously, he does not believe in the reign of law. You know?
Yeah, because the law failed him.
Yeah, because the law, and you know, and that's the entire point of Return to Big Nothing is that this is a guy who has no respect for the law whatsoever, and you know, and that was something that Marvel was a little uncomfortable with. you know, Marvel was considerably uncomfortable with the Punisher, even when he got popular. Marvel was never really comfortable with the Punisher until I think they're comfortable with him now that Garth is doing him, but. But because Garth plays him so over the top that it's, you know, kind of a comedy. But
yeah.
But, you know, we definitely weren't going for comedy.
No, but it was great. It was great, gritty stuff. And it just seemed like the shackles were off and you guys could really kind of cut loose and go as far as you wanted to go.
Yeah, pretty much. But the point of that whole miniseries, though, is that the Punisher's life is pointless. The Punisher does is pointless. I mean, he fails in that miniseries.
That's true, yeah.
I mean, he fails miserably at what he's doing. He ends up triggering far, you know, I mean, basically it brings it home to him that any violence that he commits, he's got to keep very localized, you know.
Would you ever want to get back to the character?
Well, you know, Mike and I actually always wanted to do a final Punisher story. But, you know, I mean, if they asked me to write him, sure, I'd be happy to write him. I don't have any great urge to go back to the character.
Did you read that The End story that Marvel released last year?
No, I never read anyone else's Punisher stories.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. Because the rhythms that I hear for the Punisher in my head, and I have no idea whether they translate to the page or not, but it's how I read the books that I've or the Punisher stories that I wrote. It's how I hear him speaking. Nobody else actually does. So when I try reading their books, and it's got nothing to do with whether they're good books or bad books, but when I try reading their books, their voice for the Punisher doesn't match my voice for the Punisher. And it's like listening to a record that skips.
Okay, I was going to ask if it becomes a different character, but it's worse than that.
Yeah, you know, it's well, he is a different character, but it's that the you know it's just that I hear him in a particular voice, and no one else does that voice, and it just makes it very difficult for me to read it. So, you know, it's I have plenty of other things to read. I don't need the aggravation. So, but it's you know, like I say. I mean, I'm not saying they're doing it wrong or anything like that. It's just that it doesn't match up with me. So, you know, I can live without it.
Are there other characters that you've written, mainstream characters, that, you know, once you've written it, that you have the same feeling?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. I mean, there's very few of them that I've written enough of to have a specific connection to, at least that anyone else is doing.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah, all right. I was curious. I have to ask if at this same time, were you doing those revamps of the Hardy Boys?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, again, that's the other side of the spectrum, just like the Pope was.
Well, sort of. The two-boy war against crime books. No, they actually, it was very funny because when they approached, those came out of the Electric Company magazine.
Okay.
Because the woman who was running the packaging company was my original editor on the Electric Company, on the Spidey Super Stories for the Electric Company magazine. Because I was also writing them, in addition to writing them in the comic, I was writing them in the Electric Company magazine. They had four-page Spider-Man stories,
mm-hmm.
which I think I was actually doing before I started doing the other one. And so this woman, Pat Fortunato, had left that and had formed a packaging company and asked me if I wanted to write novels. And I had done a couple of books for them in a series called Race Against Time, which was a young boy and his uncle. His uncle was actually this retired master spy, and they would run around the world. I mean, it was basically they had to run around the world and save the world and get back before his parents found out they were gone.
Okay.
You know, and then they got the Hardy Boys contract, and they had this whole idea of, you know, well, there was this whole the one-man war against crime routine. They thought, we'll redo the Hardy Boys as a two-boy war against crime, and they kill off Frank Hardy's longtime, or somebody's longtime girlfriend. I didn't write the first one, so I forget who it is. But
this is real?
Yeah, it was real. The first one, they like, you know, they originally had them with their own little, you know, war wagon with all these weapons on in the walls and things like that. And they had this whole thing. And by the time it got to mine, they'd pretty much started whittling that away. I mean, basically everyone was really cool on the concept until they started thinking about it, which was two or three books in. And then they started worrying about, well, maybe maybe parents might not like this. Because, you know, all books, all things for children, you know, people talk about kids' comics. And what they're really talking about when they're talking about kids' comics is parents' comics.
Certainly.
You know, well, they don't see it that way, but that's what they're actually talking about. So you and I can say certainly, but believe me, they don't recognize this. So what they mean is they're making they want to do comics which parents will consider safe, and it's the same thing with things like the Hardy Boys. They don't want to like put out ultra-violent books for kids, even though, you know, let's face it, they'd sell like, you know, well.
Yeah, had I known, I would have probably read them.
Yeah, and the third one. So I wrote the third one, Cult of Crime, and. After they got it, they went back and they rewrote the first two to match things that I'd done, because I pretty much started ignoring what they told me to do.
Okay.
But they originally started out, well, they carried guns. Well, then it became they didn't carry guns, but they could take them off bad guys.
Okay.
And then it became, well, they could take them off bad guys, but they couldn't shoot them. And then it became, well, they can't take them off bad guys at all. They don't use guns at all. Then they could use knives. Well, then they couldn't use knives. And then, you know, by the time you got a number of volumes into it, they're not allowed to hit anybody, you know. So you're taking a lot of space to get them actually doing nothing. But in the early ones, the first one, Cult of Crime, I actually liked that one a lot. There was that one, and then there was one later on called Nightmare in Angel City, which was great fun. Because I had, actually, it's Joe's girlfriend who gets killed, that's right, because Nightmare in Angel City has Frank's girlfriend's aunt, who's like in her late 20s, making passes at Joe, which I was very surprised they let go by. Because Joe is underage, you know.
Yeah,
Frank is of age. Frank is 18. He's cool. Joe is 17.
Okay.
He's,
I knew they were in their late teens. Okay.
Yeah. But Cult of Crime has, you know, just all this really weird stuff in it.
That's awesome. I grew up reading the original ones and stuff. And
oh, no, this is way beyond. Yeah, so did I, actually, although I was always more of a Tom Swift Jr. fan myself.
Okay,
all right. Yeah, so that was. So I did like six or seven of those.
Wow.
They got increasingly difficult to write as they went on simply because there were all these restrictions. But the first two or three of them that I wrote, there were like not many restrictions. By Nightmare in Angel City, they were getting into restrictions. So I think they were focusing much more on the violence aspect than the sex aspect. So I got the sex past. So
something to look for in the quarter bins, folks. I kind of like this. I think that's very interesting. Man.
Yeah, well, let's see. What's his name? Frank. Frank joins a cult in the Cult of Crime. You know, that's how it opens up. Frank joins a cult, and we spend like six chapters before we actually tip anyone to the idea that he's not really joining a cult.
Oh, good. There's no deprogramming Frank scene or anything. Okay.
No, but we tease it for a long time that he's actually joining it. I mean, for a lot longer than they originally wanted me to do it, you know. I mean, and they wanted me to make it very clear at the beginning that he was sneaking in and that it was an undercover assignment. And now he's like wandering around homeless for the first, chapter of the thing, and, you know, no sign that he's, you know, it's like he has left home. He gets, you know, sucked into a cult in the second chapter, and, you know, it's not until like the sixth chapter that this is obvious that he planned this all along.
Wow.
It was great fun to write those. Yeah.
All right. I'm definitely going to look for that. That's very cool. What were your first big pure crime stories? Would you say? Would you say it was The Punisher? Would you?
I'd say The Punisher probably.
Okay.
Probably Circle Blood. I mean, we wanted to do that specifically as a crime book.
Mm-hmm.
I had done some crime-oriented stuff in Whisper before that. I mean, Whisper was more of a crime book than it was never really a superhero book, but it was. Crime slash adventure book.
Okay.
Slash espionage. I mean, it had all those elements in it, but it wasn't really a superhero book, even though there was a costume. Mike and I definitely wanted to do the Punisher as a crime character, as a crime story, rather than a superhero story, which is kind of interesting because, you know, when you're working in the Marvel Universe, you have to make all kinds of allowances for things. And
sure.
But we just kind of decided to make allowances by ignoring it all. So.
Well, past The Punisher, then, what would you say was your next crime project?
Well, that'd be Badlands.
Yes, and I'm a big fan of Badlands.
Cool. Well, that was, Bill Marks had been publishing Black Kiss at Vortex.
Yes.
And wanted something to follow it up, and ran into me at a convention and said, can you come up with a crime miniseries for me? And right off the top of my head, I said, yeah, crime story set in 1963, starring the man who really killed John Kennedy. And he just went ape. He just went completely bananas. I had no story. It was right off, I don't know where it came from, it was right off the top of my head. But he said, oh, man, I got to have that. Just go write it. You know, just go, we've got a deal. Just go write that. And so I did. And it was actually one of the quickest things I'd ever written. I wrote it for the whole thing very quickly. I actually had the ending scene before, the last scene in the series I had before I had anything else. I had no idea how it was going to get there, and I had no idea what was going on, but I had the last scene in the thing.
Great, gritty story, and I also like the fact that you did the screenplay book as well, in case anybody ever wants to actually make this a movie.
Yeah, that was a preemptive strike. So.
Good for you. Do films like that fascinate you? Some of the ones that hypothesize, of course, there's Oliver Stone and JFK, but I remember in the 70s that Burt Lancaster movie called Executive Action.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I remember that. I honestly don't have a whole lot of fascination for Kennedy assassination stories. I kind of did mine, you know.
Sure.
The only other one I genuinely like is James Ellroy's American Tabloid, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
I love crime movies.
Can you name a couple crime movies, favorites of yours that come up?
The original Get Carter.
Classic.
The Orson Welles one. I'm drawing blanks on things. Touch of Evil.
Great movie.
Touch of Evil. I mean, I got all kinds of them, but they're not right here They're unfortunately not in my room. They're downstairs. But,
well, one that always gets mentioned, just because I'm such a fan of it, and it's going to lead to my next question, is his name is Savage, was based on it, point blank.
Lee Marvin. Well, I wasn't really based on it.
No?
Does it have anything, honestly, to do with it?
It seems like it's that same guy, and it seems like Gil Kane, the
well,
the
no, it isn't
creator.
Really that same guy. I mean, Gil may have. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Gil never mentioned being influenced by Point Blank.
No.
He didn't actually have anything to do with the cover.
Oh, okay. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, you know, the guy who painted the cover painted it based on Lee Marvin, but I don't think that was by direction from Gil.
Okay.
And the interior character doesn't really look like Lee Marvin at all.
Yeah, that's. I guess so. All right. Well, it's certainly got those great Gil Kane eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Those hooded eyes. Let's talk about your work with Gil Kane, because, you know, I grabbed The Last Heroes.
You're very good at segues, you know.
Well, I appreciate that. I enjoyed The Last Heroes and was fascinated to read that you were going to, you know, maybe work with Gil on a follow-up to His Name is Savage.
Yeah, well, we were talking about that pretty much until he died. He was very interested in it, but, you know, just things never came together.
That's too bad, because, I really enjoyed the original story, and I know Archie Goodwin scripted it for him, but it was really Gil's story.
Yeah.
But I thought that was neat, and it seems great. Man, you worked on The Last Heroes with Gil, and also the Superman Blood of My Ancestors story as well.
Yeah, that's kind of a bittersweet one for in a lot of ways. I mean, that was both Gil and John's last story. So
yeah. I mean, and that, but it's
kind of had me looking over my shoulder for a while there. Yeah.
Was it tough to kind of get it down and get it right, or as good as you wanted it to be?
Well, things are never as good as I want them to be. you know, I don't know if I got it right or not. You know, I
kind of a tough story. I mean, I always liked those World of Krypton stories.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, there was certainly kind of a vibe in there that reminded me of that.
Oh, no, there was, you know, there was definitely a World of Krypton story. It was, you know. The weird thing was that originally it was an Elsewhere story, and somewhere along the line they decided, well, no, this is just going to be part of continuity. And it's like, okay. You know, we didn't change anything in the story, except we added the Superman. Well, I think they wanted the Superman frame.
Okay.
Prior to that, there wasn't any Superman in the story. It was just based on Superman, you know. It was the story of Superman's first ancestor on Krypton. And I had never written Superman before. I don't have a whole lot of personal empathy for Superman. I never did. I mean, for about a year when I was 10 years old, I was a big Superman fan. Actually, a big Action Comics fan. You know, outside of that, I never really had felt a whole lot of connection with the Superman character. So it was interesting to write it. The story was Gil's idea the whole way through. I mean, Gil was very hot for it. Gil was always loved Superman. So, man, I was always, you know, more than happy to write anything Gil wanted to do. So.
Yeah, can you talk about working with Gil?
Well, it was very hard to work with him because he would always, you know, once he started talking, it was always like, you know, you'd hear the stories of the history of comics. I wish I had had a tape recorder and just gotten them all down, because I could have written like two or three books of, you know, just Gil's stories. Because Gil knew where all the skeletons were buried. And he would delight in telling the background stories of all the stories in comics. And it was, you know, so all those are like somewhere in the back of my head now. Thanks, Gil.
You were active in that 80s boom of all these, you know, new publishers suddenly coming out and new books coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing that again now. And you review a lot of them as well in your Permanent Damage column
right.
at Comic Book Resources. Can you compare the two eras? What do you think?
The thing is that things were decentralizing in the 80s. And today they're decentralized, but there's like five or six key points. Like, it's fairly easy if you want to sell a horror comic.
Okay.
But you couldn't sell a Western, you know, I mean, and I'm not talking to the public, I'm talking to publishers.
Okay.
You know, it's very hard to sell crime comics. Horror comics they can market because they got monsters, they're cool, you can look at them, but,
yeah.
You know, crime comics, you got guns, you know. To some extent, superhero comics destroyed all the other genres by absorbing them. I mean, you can't, science fiction comics, people say, you know, why aren't there any science fiction comics? Geez, you read Fantastic Four lately?
Sure. No, you're right.
And to some extent, it's the same thing with crime, except that, you know, you've got... But when I do crime, you know, I mean, I like the moral ambiguity of crime comics. I'm big on moral ambiguity.
Okay.
You know, I like the idea of main characters who don't necessarily have to be heroic and can do things. Did you read Damned?
I did not read Damned.
Okay. Because that was, you know, that was a crime comic Mike and I did a few years back that got published a couple years ago by Cyberosia in trade paperback. And, you know, and it's, it was fun because, you know, you got a character who's basically, I mean, he's got a couple of what you'd call noble characteristics, but he's not a hero. You know what always bothered me about heroes was about the concept of heroes in comics is that they're supposed to be steady state. Heroism is a steady state in comics. Most people are not hero. I mean, heroism in real life tends to be this intersection of personality and opportunity, you know, and circumstance, personality and circumstance. And someone who does something heroic one day, you know, one day in a similar situation might not do it the next time. You know, I mean, people react differently to different things even when they seem to be similar situations. But in comics, if you're a hero, you've got to act heroically all the time. You've got to, you know, be the hero.
Sure.
And you don't have to do that in crime comics.
And it seems like your book, The Last Heroes, was your kind of response to that, you
know.
Yeah,
very much, very much. You know, and Gil was very interested in that, too. I mean, The Last Heroes was genuinely supposed to be our last go at superheroes, which I guess, in a way, it turned out to be.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, it's like the Green Lantern Adam story that we did for DC, Tales of the DC Universe, or whatever it was called.
Legends.
Legends of the DC Universe,
sure.
That was it. You know, that was basically me giving Gil the opportunity to say goodbye to Green Lantern and the Atom.
You okay.
Because he was responsible for those characters. And I always wondered, and I asked Julie Schwartz about this at a convention once. I always, you know, when I was a kid, I read them, and I noticed that, you know, the same guy worked on both of them. And I always thought, you know, they were doing all these team-up, you know, they were having characters team up. And I always wondered, well, why don't they have Green Lantern and the Atom team up? Because, no, the same guy draws them. I guess we just never thought of it. But, yeah, so that was basically our way of, you know, saying goodbye to those characters. And I'd always wanted to write Green Lantern because he was my favorite character. You know, the Hal Jordan Green Lantern with Gil, because that was my favorite character when I was a kid.
Me too.
That
was one of
my
favorites.
Without Gil, it wasn't the same character. So, you know, so that was, you know, me getting those characters out of my system and Gil, you know, so being able to say goodbye to them and, you know, and then we were going to have, had Gil lived, we had planned to move on to other things, although whether that would have worked out economically or not, I couldn't tell you.
Can you mention any of those projects, or can you mention any of
those? Well,
we
didn't really have anything specific. We went from moment to moment on these things. See,
sure.
One of the big problems with working with Gil is that Gil was like shotgunned ideas, and it was very hard to keep him focused on anything for a long enough period of time to actually get it to the point where you could take it out, because the next time you spoke to him, he'd have something else that he really wanted to do, you know. and it got a little frustrating after a while, but, you know, I wouldn't have had it any other way, but, you know, I certainly beat the alternative of not talking to Gil, but on the other hand, you know, it was like, well, you know, trying to figure out ways to keep him focused on things long enough to get them to production was entertaining.
Your IDW work on CSI, do you think you'll go back to that that series?
Well, if they want me to, sure.
Okay.
Sure, I know how to write it now.
Did you?
I didn't know how to write it before. I know how to write it now, so sure, I'd go back to it.
And you got Kolchak coming up.
Yeah, well, sort of.
Okay, well, and it's a prose story.
It's a short story, yeah.
Yeah. But it's I know Moonstone is releasing, I guess, right in time for Halloween.
Oh, is it? They don't tell me anything. Right? No one ever tells me release dates on things. You know? It's like prying, you know, it's like you're going to blow their secrets or something, you know. It's like prying. It's really, publishers never tell me when books are coming out. You'd think they would. I mean, I've got a forum. I could mention it, you know.
Yes.
But do they tell me? No. It's like, you know, but, Halloween. Yeah, it's a short story. I guess there's gobs of them in the book.
Yeah, and it's and a great number of writers. Yourself, Max Collins. I think Peter David is in there as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Peter wrote a story.
So that's and it's classic Kolchak. I know they've got the new series coming out, and we've got to reimagine Kolchak.
Well, it's sort of classic Kolchak.
Okay.
How do you pronounce the name?
Kolchak.
Kolchak. Okay. It's either Kolchak or Kolchak.
Well, close enough.
I forget. You know, I was never a huge fan of the series myself.
Really? Oh, I love that series.
Now, a lot of people I knew loved the series, but I never liked horror TV. I never was a big fan of that kind of stuff. But yeah, what do you want to know about it?
Well, I guess I don't want to tip anything, especially if it's a short story. So I'll just say.
Well, it's the stories. They're about the original the Earth. I guess the Earth 2 Kolchak.
Yeah, the Golden
They're
Age
about
Kolchak.
The Earth 2 Kolchak, but the details fit the Earth 1 Kolchak.
Okay.
So, you know.
That's cool.
That's as much as I can tell you about it. It's you know, Earth 2 and Earth 1, because I get that, you know, you got to remember that the older one is the Earth 2 version.
That's right.
You know. So.
Let's talk about your column at Comic Book Resources.
Yeah.
Permanent Damage. I enjoy it. I read it every week. I think it's interesting right now that you're currently working on showing the various steps of creating a comic book.
Well, it's kind of a rough draft for a book.
Okay.
The whole thing. You know, so obviously I spent a lot of time on writing because that's, you know, writing and conceiving the things, that's, you know, my end of it.
Sure.
Right now I'm fumbling through the rest of it because I keep thinking of things I should have, you know, put in there. And so it'll probably be several columns on penciling comics, like the nuts and bolts of penciling comics, which is interesting to do when you don't have illustrations to go with it. You know, I think in the book I'd have to include illustrations, but right now I don't, you know, really have the resources or the time to hire someone to do illustrations for me, and I can't draw to save my soul. So, you know, I can see it to save my soul, but I can't draw it to save my soul.
People have asked you before if, you know, you're going to collect your other previous columns and make them into books, and I know that you've got PDFs of collections,
right,
on your website, papermovies.com. So this will be finally the full-fledged book?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, I've actually already had people ask me about publishing it, so it's, you know.
That's cool.
But I'm not rushing to finish it because I want to, you know, I want to get as much of it out there as possible to start with, because like I say, this is the rough draft, so when I'm done with this, I can look at it and see where I got it wrong, and then I can straighten it out. Although I don't think I'm getting much of it wrong, but it's more omissions than errors, I think. And, you know, in this way I can get feedback from artists who I've offended and things like that, and I can take that into consideration. Well, you know, I mean, I say things that can be interpreted in nasty, derogatory ways, although they're not meant that way. But, you know, I found out a long time ago you can only control how you're interpreted just so much, and past a certain point it's not worth bothering with. And, you know, I mean, you're misinterpreted, you say, oh, sorry, and you correct it, and that's the end of it, you know, and it's like... That's just say, well, that's not what I meant, but I'll change. I'll make sure it's changed. So, you know, and then they feel good because then they feel that they've had an input and you've listened to them, and everybody's happy. And you know, it's this give and take kind of thing.
Do you have a title for the book?
No, I haven't got a title yet.
Okay.
But I've got a subtitle, which is on the column, which, you know, the Down and Dirty Guide to Creating Comics. But that's basically the concept behind the thing, is that it's easy. It's like I say, I mean, people have these glamorous notions, and I'm out to disrupt any glamorous notions anyone has. It's you know, it's fun, but it's a job. It's like this saying that I came up with years ago, which is that every restaurant is a greasy spoon when you get into the kitchen.
Yes.
And it's the same concept. It's like, you know, nothing is glamorous when you have to do it for a living. People may think that it's an exciting, wonderful thing to and creative and inventive thing to do comics, and it is, and I'm not denying that it is, but it's not always that. And a lot of the things that people are just flabbergasted with, you know, that just people are in awe of, are just really basically very simple tricks that people pick up, and, you know, they're not hard to disseminate. And it's the stuff that you can't teach people that is always the stuff they really want to know. Like, everybody wants to know the secret.
Right.
And the secret is that there isn't a secret, you know, and that's not a secret. There's a Leonard Cohen song that has a line in it that goes, I never said I had a secret chart to get me to the heart of this, something like
no,
and that's kind of what it's about. You know, it's like, yes, you can do it if you want to, but there is no, you know, I'm trying to take the mystery out of it.
Sure. I also like in your columns the fact that you do review so many books, because there is such a ton of books that come out every week, and it's impossible to, you know, keep tracking. I mean, everyone is, you know, there are mainstream fans and there are alternative fans, but it seems like, you know, sometimes you really do need someone to say, no, check this out, it's good. And I'm glad to see that you review as many books as you do.
Well, you know, I mean, I basically review everything that's sent to me. There's only one book, and I won't tell you what it is, that I refuse to review anymore.
Okay.
And there is one book that I refuse to review anymore because, you know, another of my sayings, you don't have to cut your finger off to know you're going to bleed. And it's like, I don't really need to read anymore because I know it's, you know, they have plenty of chance, and I don't honestly think it's whether it gets better or not, it's never going to get to something that I'm interested in reading. So, you know, there's no point in my, you know, belittling them in the column anymore. But outside of that, you know, I mean, pretty much everything anything anyone sends me, I'll review.
That's very cool.
That's my bond with them. If you send it to me, I will review it. I might not give you a good review, but I will review it.
No, that's very cool.
Almost everything.
And as we wrap up, I want to ask, you know, is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to mention that might be coming out soon?
A couple of issues ago in The Escapist, I did a story with Norm Breyfogle called Weird Date.
Yeah, that was great.
And that was, you know, basically I was asked a long time ago if I wanted to contribute something to the book, and I said, well, you know, does it have to be an escapist story? And they said no. And they said, you know, basically we have The Escapist and Luna Moth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, but there's all these things in the book, and if you want to pick something and something else and do a story about it, that's fine. And I stumbled across, it's mentioned once in it, it's this book that's called Weird Date for some, and I saw Weird Date, and it was like my head exploded, and I just thought, oh my God, that's such a great concept. And I had all these Jack Cole crime comics blowing up in my mind at that point, you know, and it's like, and I wanted that kind of thing. And so I did one of those with Norm Breyfogle, and they liked it enough that they asked me to do another one. So I brought in Sean McManus to do a one that's more of an EC comic story.
Okay.
The first one was a romance story that turned into a Jack Cole crime comic.
Oh, yeah, I read it. I remember it well. It was great.
And, if you've ever seen Jack Cole crime comics, they're like the most frenetic things on paper. You know? It's like they vibrate, you know. It's like they're great to look at, you know. They just, you know, it's like just. And this one was a romance story that turns into an EC horror story.
Oh, that's cool.
And
well, that's a great,
you know,
thing.
And Sean
about
McManus drew that one. It really looks nice, and that should be coming out sometime in the next few months.
That's a great thing about that series. I mean, you know, Chabon really kind of did give you that whole framework of an entire comic book company. And I'm really glad that Dark Horse is, like, taking it to that next level and stories like you just said. I mean, that's just great.
Well, I think we kind of broke open new ground with that. So, in terms of what they were looking for the book. And also, no one has really done romance comics like that for a long. I mean, they're not really romance comics. They always end up being more of the other thing. But they are romance comics. I mean, we use a lot of the romance comics gimmicks and things. You know, I went back and read a lot of 50s romance comics and saw the different sorts of narrative gimmicks and things that they don't do anymore, like having, like, the narrative panels with, like, one little symbolic picture in them or something,
mm-hmm.
You know, which you can use to just cover. I mean, it's just a wonderful technique to use because you can imply all kinds of things with those. And no one uses them anymore, you know. So it was great fun going back and finding all these old techniques that could be dusted off and updated. And, you know, so hopefully we'll be doing more of those. And Sean and I are talking about doing, you know, I'm talking with a lot of artists about doing stuff, but it's the artists aren't hard to find. It's the publishers that are hard to find.
No, I got you.
But, you know, I'll probably be doing some stuff with Boom Studios very soon.
Okay.
And, you know, basically all comes down to getting artists to finish drawing stuff, really. I'm talking with a lot of people about a lot of things, but, the industry has changed a lot in the last 20 years in terms of how comics are put together. And it's much more like the movie business now. Getting the whole package put together and then finding a publisher. It used to be you'd go to a publisher and they'd say, well, can you write this and this?
I got you.
You know,
and now you're bringing the projects to them.
Yeah, and now you have to put the projects together and bring them to them. And, you know, I can get projects sold with no problem. I just can't get them sold to publishers who pay me.
Well, I hope that fortune changes soon.
Yeah, me too. It would be nice. I'm also got a lot of things going on in Hollywood right now and things like that. But
that's cool.
Those will ultimately pay off, I can't really say. You know, because like I say, I mean, it's Hollywood I can't wait to see how Marvel does in Hollywood. Well, you know, there's this old joke, which is how do you make a large fortune in Hollywood? I mean, how do you make a small fortune in Hollywood? You start with a large fortune.
Unbelievable. Well, there you go.
Well,
listen, Steve, this has been great. I hope we covered everything that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
And sure, I'm easy.
And then, yeah, if we could do it again in the future, that'd be great.
Okay, well, you got my number.
That'll wrap things up for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. Be sure to check in at wordballoon.com for more information about upcoming interviews. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2005.